And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us, listening on WILL AM, and also if you're watching through our website, we are webcasting this hour of the show. That's at WILL.illinois.edu. Either way, glad to have you with us. This morning, we will have another, in fact, the last, in a series of conversations that we have been having with candidates who will compete in next week's Illinois primary. And we have talked with people who are running for the State House and also for Congress. And this morning, in this hour, our guest is Illinois State Representative Chapin Rose. He is a Republican, currently represents the 110th District in the Illinois House, and he is one of two Republicans seeking their party spot on the ballot in the new 51st District of the Illinois State Senate. He is a graduate of the University of Illinois, went to law school here, serving in the House before being elected to the Illinois House. He was a senior assistant state's attorney for Champaign County, and we're pleased to have him here in the studio with us to talk about some of the basic issues confronting the state. His opponent in the primary is Tom Plura. He was on this program on February 27th. That show is on our web archive, so if you'd like to go back and listen or watch, you can do that. It is there, and this show will be archived as well. We are here and ready to take questions. If you'd like to talk with Chapin Rose, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, you can use that. That's 800-222-9455. And we also have email, so you can send us a message or a question. That way, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, David. My pleasure.
We appreciate it. One thing that we definitely want to talk about is the state budget and the
sure.
state's fiscal condition.
Absolutely.
And certainly it's clear we have some really serious problems. Even with the tax increase that was passed last January, we got a big backlog of bills, and there's concerns about how we'll deal with pensions, how we'll deal with Medicaid. I want to talk specifically about some of those things, but tell me generally, what's your approach to the fiscal challenge that now the legislature is facing?
Sure. Well, like a lot of people, a couple of years ago, I just got fed up and, you know, sat around and said to myself, my gosh, you know, this can't keep. In fact, I'll tell you, 5 years ago, I actually was the first person to call for across the board cuts because I could see where this was headed. Asked for a 5% across the board cut. Had they done that then, some of this, perhaps all of it, could have been avoided. But about 3 years ago, I just said, you know, this challenge can be solved. This problem can be solved. I mean, we're Americans, and that's what we do. We solve problems. And so what I did, I grabbed the state budget book. It's about 3 inches thick. And I downloaded it to an Excel file, and I started going through it line by line. We don't need this. We do need that, but maybe not as much of it. You know, mm-hmm. we do need this. And so I went through it and just made some you know, basically changes. And amazingly, at the end of the day, it took about a week, to be honest with you. It was a little bit more than a day. But in about a week's time, I had identified about $4 billion in cuts that were, you know, that I thought were reasonable, didn't harm the core mission of government, which is to keep people safe, good schools, good higher education, and published it, $4.8 billion. In response to that, actually, I was nominated to a post within our leadership team, budget team, to basically be one of our budget negotiators, and particularly for higher education. Now, I grew up in Charleston, EIU, so I've been, I was new to U of I, as you mentioned, was been very much around higher education my entire life, and so I'm the minority spokesman for the Higher Education Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. And so we basically, as part of that process of identifying those cuts, was put on that team. Now, I want to give folks a little bit of hope that things are being done differently. This past year saw a budget that from a structural, from a fundamental, from a process perspective was totally unlike any other in the last 25 years. It started with the House of Representatives using an outside econometrics group to produce a revenue target. So it wasn't, you know, four individuals plus the governor sitting behind closed doors making up a number out of thin blue air. They actually hired economists with PhDs They looked at national state trends and said, this is what we think you're going to have. We then said, hey, no business in America, in the world, would plan to spend everything they think they might have. So we undershot that by $1.2 billion, just out of being conservative fiduciary budgeting principle. And then we said there are certain obligations you have to pay. Like, for example, the state of Illinois collects sales tax on behalf of local municipalities. That is not the state taxpayers' money. That's the local taxpayers' money. So that needs to go back to them. So those things come off the top. That then got you to a net number that was available from a budgeting perspective. Now, this is very important because of the first time in a long time that the grocery cart wasn't loaded before you looked in your wallet to see how much you had to spend. Okay. Secondly, and I think even more importantly, again, to fundamental democracy and for the citizens of Illinois, this process was adopted by a unanimous vote. There weren't any Republicans or Democrats. There wasn't any Chicago versus downstate. It was everybody. And then what they did after adopting this number and making the required subtractions, we got to the net number. We then went through, and again, this is unanimous, we then went through the state budget sectors, the five major sectors, higher ed, K-12, human services, public safety, general services. And we said, okay, in the last 5 years, on average, what have you had as a percentage? And we then took that percentage against that net number, and that's all the committees had to deal with. And so in the case of the higher ed committee, we went back as Democrats and Republicans, sat down, and went through the budget line by line, made the cuts until we got to that number. Now, David Leach, who's been there since the early 80s, has said that this is the first time since 1984 the budget was done the way it's supposed to be done. The reality is that that's a good thing going forward. Now, there are some things that didn't work on it. Human Services Committee has been mired a little bit on Medicaid and how to handle that. There was about $400 million in savings that was passed last year, which was good. But they are ongoing in their efforts into this through this fiscal year and for next fiscal year. We've adopted sort of the same approach this time around to budgeting. But I will also say this, that the Human Services, the Medicaid issue actually, and this is very interesting. The governor in a state of the budget address came in and it was very stark and I thought somber and sobering as it should be. And it was the first time I saw sort of a generalized acceptance on the part of the governor that, hey, there's some of us have been saying this for a long time.
Yeah.
And finally the governor comes in. I think his phrase was the rendezvous with reality. Yeah. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
But to have a good speech is one thing, to implement is another thing. So what was most encouraging is I'm one of our negotiators on Medicaid. The governor in his speech called for $2.7 billion in reductions in Medicaid. The very next morning at 8 a.m., we were all in a room, the four caucuses in the governor's office, talking about this. And in fact, to his credit, he came in and plopped down $2.7 billion in specific cuts. Now, some of them, people are going to cheer, say, why didn't you do that already? Some of them are going to be things that, quite frankly, I won't vote for. I mean, there's some things in there, particularly with respect to development disabled funding, I won't support. You don't bounce the budget on the back of development disabled folks. But on balance, I feel very confident that everyone in that room is there to get to a balanced budget, one. And two, also in these conversations, is the notion of paying down the bills. Now, that's a two-part step there. You got to finish the budget deficit, which the current budget cut about $2.8 billion. And what we're down to now is largely the backlog of bills. So we're going to have to get those paid down. But I would note that, you know, the state of Illinois, on a if you peel away the layers of some of these large numbers, you hear $8 billion in unpaid bills. If you peel away the layers, the state would spend about $2.4 billion a month. Okay, some months more, some months less. So if you shot for a spending target, it says we're going to get to 90 days payment cycle and accomplish that target. Then you're going to shoot for a target that says we're going to get to 60 days and accomplish that target. That's part of a plan. That's part of a strategy. And eventually you'll get to where you need to be. So that's kind of where we're at. I do believe this is a 2 to 3 year process still. The first step was this year's budget, which cut $2.8 billion. One of the things that's, I think, first and foremost is just the transparency of the process of having everybody say on the front, this is what it is, this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah. I want to get in depth in some of these things. We have a couple of callers ready to go. Let me just say to people who are listening on WILL AM or watching through our website, will.illinois.edu, we're talking this morning with Chapin Rose. He represents the 110th District in the Illinois House and will be competing in the primary, the March primary here in Illinois next week. One of two Republicans who are competing to represent their party in the new 51st District of the Senate, Illinois State Senate. Questions are certainly welcome. We hope people can be brief just so we can keep moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send your questions by email, you can do that too. That's will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. Here are some callers, starting with Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good day. Yes, I'm slated to be a constituent here of Mr. Rose. I've known him for many years, back to his days at the University of Illinois College of Law, when he personally organized our annual St. Patrick's Day bar crawls. And when I told Mr. Rose that this event was anti-Irish, anti-Catholic, anti-Christian, he then proceeded to desecrate the shamrock that St. Patrick used to teach the mysteries of the Holy Trinity to the Irish. So based upon my long-standing knowledge and experience dealing with Mr. Rose, he is anti-Irish, anti-Catholic, anti-Christian, and a binge drinker. And I certainly will not be voting for him. Thank you.
Well, if I can respond to that, Professor Boyle, how you doing today, I might add. You left a few things out there. First of all, and I think you've called in every time we're on this show with the same complaint, you left out that that was for, organized for charity, and it was organized to help provide books for law students. It was a fundraiser to provide books for law students who had a hard time paying for law school. You left that part out. As for being Irish, Professor Boyle, I am Irish. I also happen to be a Christian, and by the way, I don't drink, so I think that's all I have to say to that. Thanks.
Let's go to another caller, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi, my name is Mark Jacobs, and I'm not calling to make any kind of personal attack.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I want to get your comments on my situation.
Sure.
I am 56 years old. In 1996, I graduated from the U of I with a master's degree in library science. But around the year 2001, 2002, I began to notice that my eyesight was failing and it was uncorrectable. I am now, I've used up the majority of my savings and I'm using, I'm on Social Security. And believe me, Social Security disability doesn't come close to meeting my obligations.
Sure.
So I hear a lot of talk about people paying their own way and cutting costs and so on, but I wonder if you have any comments to make about my situation, because I don't think I'm a person who's taking advantage of the system.
Sure, Mark. Thanks for calling in. And a couple things. One, first of all, as respects Social Security, that's federal and I'm at the state level. But one of the things, and I think a priority for me on the Medicaid commission, is, I said earlier, to not balance the budget on the backs of developmentally disabled or the so-called ABD populations, age, blind, and disabled, and which, of course, if you're having eyesight issues, you would fall in that category. Something that listeners might be interested to know about me is my wife actually is an occupational therapist who works and has spent most part of her career dealing with developmentally disabled constituencies. So we have a very realistic approach to how this would go. And, you know, for example, last year when the governor suggested cutting about it was about $90 million. I can't remember the exact dollar amount, but it was right around target of about $90 million that would have come out of state grants for the disabled. And that would be all grants from everything from the, circumstance like yours all the way up to severe developmental disabilities. And we were able to restore through frankly cutting other places all but $1 million of the governor's proposed grant or proposed cut. So in his introduced budget, he was going to cut $90 million, which quite frankly would have been, this community development, DSC. We're very familiar with DSC and the services they provide. In the southern part of my current district, you get CTF and some of those areas. His proposed cuts would have frankly been devastating. And through cutting elsewhere, through efficiencies and through economies of scale, we were able to restore all, like I said, all but $1 million of that. So I guess my general response to your question, Mark, is, this is going to be tough and it's not going to be fun, but I go into this with the right attitude that says, we have an ethical and moral obligation to help those who are either A, down in their luck through no fault of their own, or truly can't help themselves because they were born with some sort of genetic issue, and we want to help those people.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
right,
Mark.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The guest this morning in this hour focus is Chapin Rose. He is in the Illinois State House, represents the 110th District, and he is one of two Republicans who will compete in the primary next week to have their party spot on the ballot in the new 51st Senate District, Illinois State Senate District. Let's come back to Medicaid, because as you said, and a lot of people have said, if we don't find some way to reduce what we're spending on Medicaid, we're going to have a huge crisis. I guess they'd say we already have a crisis. And as you said, the governor has said we need to cut $2.7 billion. People who are looking at this said, well, really, if you're going to attack this problem, you have three things you can do. You can cut reimbursements to providers, mm-hmm. which in the past, I think the General Assembly has not been inclined to do. Mm-hmm. You can change the rules so that you can cut down on the number of people who are eligible, mm-hmm. or you can look at the services that are provided. And the state of Illinois, in fact, does provide some things the federal government doesn't require. Mm-hmm. So there's some possibility there. So of those three things, what do you think that we should do?
Well, there's actually a couple more that aren't on that list.
Okay.
And let's start with a simple one, which is if you actually get to the point where you've got this budget deficit solved and you're paying your providers on time, then you're not having to pay interest expense that comes along with it.
Okay.
That's about $100 million a year. So now, $2.7 billion right now, right there, you're down to $2.6 billion. Okay? And that didn't touch anything other than being more prudent and saving the taxpayers' interest expense. And I think that's the goal. Now, you can't front load that. That's something that comes in after you do all these other things that we're discussing here today. The other things, too, don't forget about the efficiencies that are going to be gained from things like bidding group specialty drug program, okay? And this is a kind of a pet peeve of mine. It was my idea. It was in the bill that passed last year, and it's going to come online this year. It'll save about $27 million. I got it from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania competitively bids specialty meds. These are meds that are usually created for a single day, single use. Perhaps somebody's got in chemotherapy and their blood count one day is X, and so they have to have a preparation to deal with X. The next day it's Y, and so they have to have a different preparation to deal with Y. Very expensive. When Pennsylvania competitively bid that, they saved about $28 million. We are almost uniformly, it's a very nice composite comparison between Illinois and Pennsylvania. Same size, geographic diversity, regional diversity, ethnic diversity. I mean, rural, urban, it's a very nice comparison. So we'll save about $27 million off of that. That's actually coming online. We also have an analytical software system that's going to come online, and this is going to be a big savings in on two fronts. One, it'll help root out waste and frankly fraudulent activity. I mean, if somebody's filling three Vicodin prescriptions at three different pharmacies, it'll be able to catch that, trigger it, and go deal with that. But more importantly, I think from a human element, if someone doesn't fill their prenatal vitamins, it'll catch that, and we'll be able to respond and say, hey, what's going on? How come you didn't get your prenatal vitamins? You know, it goes without saying that no one wants a baby born with a birth defect because there weren't prenatal vitamins. You know, that's not good for anyone, certainly not the baby. But from a taxpayer perspective, it's also extremely expensive once the baby's born with that issue. So on the front end, there's some savings to be had. That's coming online. I do have a concern, quite frankly, in the Medicaid task force meetings. There's kind of a push to shunt the conversation entirely towards rate. That's going to be part of it. There's no doubt about it. In fact, that was the one major sticking point that was left undone from the current fiscal year budget and is still ongoing. That's going to have to be dealt with. But you also have a lot of things, like, for example, in the governor's own documents, there's $100,000 in there for a torture treatment center. Well, what on earth is a torture treatment center? Why are we paying $100,000 for it? You know, as Mark just talked about, we have trouble, you know, helping people who actually need help, but we're spending $100,000 on a torture treatment center. So there's little things like that that add up. Then there's some pretty big things. And I think you're going to get into some conversations and where do you draw the line? What is the right level of eligibility? At one point in time under Blagojevich, it was upwards of $100,000. Now it's at $67,000, which, by the way, is far more than any other of our surrounding Midwestern states have. And so where do you draw that, you know, draw that line? You know, there are a lot of other things that, you, when you look at it, are somewhat duplicated systems, duplicated processes. Indiana went to a statewide call center system with two locations a few years ago, saved them about $80 million. So there are a lot of things like that you can do. You are going to have to go to reimbursement. You are going to have to go to eligibility. You know, and I think I've initiated my, you know, kind of my position that the place that you don't go is development disabled folks.
Yeah. Well, I got some callers here I want to get, but I just, so before, I think last year, the governor talked about cutting back on the reimbursements. And I think the General Assembly just said, no, we're not going to do that. So you think this time around there would be a willingness to actually accept cuts to say, among the things we got to do, one of the things is we've got to cut what we're paying providers.
Listen, I think the providers realize that. And in fact, they're at the table coming up with their own plans as well. And I think that let's talk a little bit of common sense here. When you tell somebody you're going to pay them X and they don't get X because you don't pay them on time and they have to go to a bank and take out a loan, okay, they're going to have an interest expense, and not all Medicaid providers are eligible for the reimbursement. And we're beyond. Let me restate that. Not all of our human service providers are eligible for the interest reimbursement for late payments. So several of them are going to private banks, taking out notes for cash flow. There's an interest cost to them. In other words, they're already eating that interest cost. If at the end of the day, you have a promise to pay them on time, you can cut that off the rate without hurting anybody because they're already paying it to a bank. Now, that's the big if. And from my perspective, whatever happens, it has to come along with basically a commitment that says you're going to be paid on time. And I think that is the I think that a lot of the hospitals and nursing homes and folks like that are coming in and saying, look, we can work with you on rate, but we have to be sure that we're not going to have to go back to the bank and borrow because we're getting paid late. Now, this is a two-step process. As I said before, you absolutely have to get the deficit under control. I mean, that's it. The state budget this year cut $2.7 billion. Actually, for the most part, staunched the bleeding. Next year, this one we're negotiating now needs to finish that job and begin paying down these bills. And to be honest with you, when you're dealing with a number as large as a $2.7 billion cut, and that's the number the governor suggested, I might add. So I'm sort of taking him at his word right now. We'll have negotiations on this as we go. But when you have that, you know, Medicaid is 37% of the state budget. It's on its way to double before by 2020. And at that point, it'll be something less than about basically three-quarters of the state budget. It has to be dealt with. We have to provide the critical services to those who truly need them, and we have to eliminate the waste and inefficiencies. There's just no other way around it.
We have several callers here want to get in, and we'll go next to we'll talk somebody in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to vote for Mr. Rose. I've heard him talk several times.
Thank you.
And I certainly enjoyed his response to Professor Boyle.
There's more to that story, as you can imagine.
I have a non-budget question.
Yes, sir.
Some time ago, I was astonished to read that you not only voted for, but I believe proposed a bill to allow certain groups to be issued identification cards without pictures. Could you amend that?
Yeah, sure. No problem. Well, and actually, that was a little bit of a misnomer in the story, but I represent the Amish community in Arthur, Illinois, and one of the problems, obviously, that we have it's kind of interesting when you have older Amish coming into contact with modern society, they don't take pictures, and it's part of their First Amendment position as a religion, and with events post 9/11. They can't get bank accounts. They can't transfer property. All the rules that came in that say you have to show a picture ID. Now, they have said that they're more than happy to provide, quite frankly, what's better than a picture ID, which is a thumbprint, a fingerprint. A fingerprint is much better. And what we tried to do is come up with something that could accommodate the First Amendment freedom of religion grounds for the Amish, but at the same time retain the security of banking, and quite frankly, comply with federal law under the Patriot Act. And what the bill actually did was it said that they would have to have basically a verifier vouch that that's who they are and provide a thumbprint, which is, again, a fingerprint. Now, if I was a prosecutor, if you ask most people in law enforcement, a thumbprint's better than a picture any day of the week. I mean, you know, if you get a picture at 18 and you come back in at 30, it's totally different person. If you get a picture without a beard and you get a beard, it's a totally different person. You know, and listen, in Arthur, everybody knows everybody. You know, when you go to the State Bank of Arthur, it's a little bit silly for the Miller brothers that are at the bank and have been at the bank forever to not be able to do a loan for, you know, Alvin Yoder or whoever it is that they've known their whole life. So what we tried to do, and it got blown a little bit out of proportion, was to basically allow, the sheriff or somebody else to come in and say, yes, this is in fact Alvin Yoder. I see him in person. It's him. He can go ahead and buy his property. And then Alvin would give you a thumbprint, which is your security. That if something came down later, you'd have that as a transaction. So that's what it was. It got blown a little bit out of proportion, but quite frankly, the Amish are actually very interesting group of individuals, very dynamic, hardworking group of people. And at some level, you know, this is the United States of America. I find it incredible that we, in this day and age, we tell somebody they can't transfer property, own property, open a bank account without infringing on their religious principle. And all we try to do is find a happy medium that would allow them to go about their business and at the same time comply with the federal regs.
Now, will the Muslims cooperate with this?
Didn't really impact them, to be honest.
It has in other places, I know.
Well, we spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and we limited it, okay? And there's actually a court case on this that the Islamic faith would not be impacted by this law. But, again, the point of it was to have, you still have the verification of who it is. It would be, you know, that's David Enge or it's not David Enge. And you'd have somebody that stands there and says, I've known David Enge for 20 years, and that's him.
That's him.
Let him sign the deed.
Yeah. Well, I've only had one comment.
Yeah.
I'm glad my wife isn't Amish because she has no fingerprints. She had eczema, I think it was, when she
really?
Was a child. Yeah, just not very long
ago. Well, I will tell you this. Oddly enough, the state police have allow the Amish to get photoless FOID cards but with a fingerprint. That is, they're now re-examining that. But here's the funny thing about this, and this is what's so silly. Current law allows them to get a photoless driver's license, but they're not supposed to drive. So you're supposed to have and that's how crazy this is. And, I mean, at some point in time, we've gotten so caught up in modern society that we've gotten away from just the common sense. I mean, you know, the Miller brothers that run the bank there, they know everybody in town. It just gets a little crazy, but we try to do it, and you'll be glad to know it's not going anywhere. So,
we're talking this morning, this hour of Focus, with State Representative Chapin Rose, who we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, Indiana; Milo's in Urbana and Escobar's in Champaign; and Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us listening on WILL AM. Maybe you're watching through our website. We're webcasting this hour of the show, and that's at WILL.illinois.edu. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll do our regular monthly show on personal finance. Kevin Wasby will be our guest. He's here occasionally. Sometimes, most of the time, it's Dave Sinnoh. Sometimes, though, Kevin stops by. He's a lecturer in finance in the U of I College of Business. So if you have questions about investing, money management, we'll take them. Second hour tomorrow, this is very specific financial topic about taxes coming up soon to a country near you. It will be time to file your taxes, and if you have questions, we'll have two accountants in the studio with us, John Breen and Marty Verdick from the local firm of McGladrey and Pullen, to take questions on 2011 federal and state taxes. Celeste Quinn will be the host for the show. You can check the schedule, find out what we'll do in the days ahead by going to our website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Chapin Rose. He's a state representative, represents the 110th District in the Illinois House, and is one of two Republicans who will be competing in the primary next week for the spot, the Republican spot on the ballot for the new 51st District of the Senate, Illinois State Senate. His opponent, Tom Plura, was here on this program on February 27th. That's archived on our website. So will this be, in fact, all the conversations we've had with candidates, they're all on the website. So if you want to go and listen or look at them, you certainly can. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller, Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi, we're going to disagree, but Illinois, for being an industrial state, is a low tax state. You can look at the figures, the last tax increase. I think either pushed us ahead of Missouri, and we're still behind Indiana, or vice versa. So that's not something we hear often. I just wanted to get it out there. I don't expect you to agree. This is with an overall assessment of taxes as well, not just income tax. But since you had been talking about the problems with this, the back debts, the back payments to various social service agencies, doctors, all sorts of things, where did you come down on which even the Chamber of Commerce supported this idea of basically a debt consolidation loan, getting a lower rate? Now, this was talked about for a long, long time. There are accusations that Quinn wanted to do it in a way that provided him some money to do other things, but it just seems like there could have been a compromise to do this refi, basically, and it didn't happen. Just didn't happen. Just even just for the back debts, and Chamber of Commerce supported it. I just don't understand why that did not go ahead, and I don't know what kind of work you did on it. You've been talking about this
Sure.
problem a lot, so it could have been done before the downgrade of the status for borrowing too, and maybe it would have helped avoid that.
The couple things. One is the governor proposes pretty heavy last year. His proposal, though, was to do more than refi. It was about $12 billion, which essentially pre-borrowed against 2 years deficit spending. And that was why so many people opposed it, because he came in and he looked out and said, well, we're running about $3-4 billion behind. There's a $3-4 billion annual deficit. So I'm going to do 12 and essentially pre-borrow 2 years worth of cash flow. That's why it didn't happen. Oddly, people went to him and suggested they cut it. In fact, and you got to be careful how you do this, because you don't want to convert cheaper debt to more expensive debt and cost the taxpayers even more money. But people went to him and said, why don't you put together the package of debt and tell us what that amount is that has an interest rate that would be higher than what you could get on the market, and then come back and you know, tell us what that is, and you'd evaluate that. He, for whatever reason, stuck to his guns and just kept going with the $12 billion plan, and that's why it didn't go anywhere.
If I could interject here, what I'm asking is, why didn't the House and the Senate at least get together and agree with this and send it forward and say, okay, refi is a good idea. We don't agree with the overhang or the further spending, but challenge him to veto the bill that would have just redone the refi.
Because first of all, you have to have those numbers, and the chief executive, and this is one of the problems that we've run into, a big problem that we run into, is exactly how many bills are sitting in the executive office that haven't been sent to the comptroller. So when you go to the comptroller and say, how many bills are outstanding? So this is what we have in the queue. But that doesn't count the bills that haven't been sent over yet for payment. And so you have a very real data problem, and then you also have an even bigger data problem of identifying which of those bills are interest-bearing versus non-interest-bearing. And so to do that, you really do need the cooperation of the governor, not to mention once he vetoes, it becomes supermajority votes. Let's talk about now. I will tell you, every discussion we have in our budget room is based on paying down the bills. Like I said, two-step process. You eliminated the deficit spending this year with the one caveat that the Medicaid rate issue is still ongoing, and that's being discussed as we speak, and I've been clear on that point. But everything else was kind of in line, and now with this new budget year, the goal is to finish that job and begin paying down these bills. And you know, it's going to be part of a methodical and thoughtful process. You know, in fact, if the governor's office wants to repropose that, I'm sure people would listen, be willing to listen. But he is, so far, no one's going to vote to pre-borrow billions of dollars and convert non-interest-bearing debt to interest-bearing debt. That's not in anyone's best interest.
Well, here, and again, I want to thank the caller. We got some others I want to get to. Just, I want to ask this question, though, because I'm confused. Every time somebody talks about the figure for the unpaid bills, I'm hearing all kinds of different numbers. So what is it? What is the backlog of unpaid bills today?
Well, what they would estimate would be $7 to $8 billion, depending on the month you ask. And the reason that jumps is because some months have short-term debt notes that come due, and so you might have a $600 million cash outflow to pay that note. While that's going out the door on the note, you're accruing a bill somewhere else. So that's going to fluctuate slightly. But the point I would make to you is that, you know, on an annual basis, you're a 30-day, if you just took the state budget divided by 12, you'd be at about $2.4 billion would be a 30-day payment cycle if you had a steady, you know, if you had steady income in and steady outflow out, which doesn't happen. Keep in mind, 9 months out of the year, you have school districts in effect, not 12 months out of the year. So you're never going to have a steady 30-day, you know, expense line. But it's, you can say $2.3 billion. So if you wanted to get to 60 days, it'd be $4.6 billion, okay? and then which basically tells you that right now you're about 4 to 5 months behind. And my point would be to start shooting at targets that are achievable, and rather than try to swallow, you know, this whole thing in a single year, say, hey, we're going to get to 3 months is the goal, and then we're going to get to 2 months, and do it in a strategic, thoughtful manner that accomplishes the goal.
And how many years do you think it would, if you were doing that, how many years would it take to really get to, to eat this, to eat this down?
Listen, if you do the types of things that are being discussed in this year's budget, it would take about 2 years. If you're going to cut more, you could do it in less. If you're going to cut less, it's going to take more. And that's going to be the trade-off at the end of the day is, you know, how much do you want to, how far do you want to go on the cuts to pay down the bills? And there's going to be a, have to be a balance there. And so at the end of the day, though, my thought is just, let's set reasonable targets that are sustainable and achievable and go after them.
Let's talk with some of the folks here. Spring Bay is next. Line four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. What I find so depressing about our politics these days is that it's so focused on the what's right in front of us. Use the analogy, if you're a rat in a maze, there's always a wall right in front of your nose until you finally get to the end, and then you get whacked. And so my comment, I guess, would be let's dial it out a little bit and try to look at some strategic thinking. What is our situation? Where are we? Where are we going? Situation is we're in the early stages of climate change, maybe more. I spoke with Dave Leach a couple of years ago. He's in absolute denial. As a downstate Republican, I wouldn't be surprised if you were too. Under any metric that you use to look at society today, we've got major problems: education, health, economics. And we're not arriving at any consensus as to what constitutes reality and how we can best deal with that. All I hear over and over again, lower taxes, get the government off my back, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're probably against so-called Obamacare. Well, you know, how do we start to deal with the health of the people of this state and country? So I guess you can get my drift here. I'm suggesting that we need to become more strategic in our thinking because we've got facing us climate change and also the cheap oil energy is gone. How are we going to power this society in the future when we're already buckling at $4 a gallon? The Illinois Department of Transportation keeps putting out more and more plans on how to build more highways, more bridges. We're not going to have the money to maintain the infrastructure we got. So that's my comment. I'll get off and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks. Thanks for your comment. And first of all, I would note that I actually drive a Toyota Yaris, which is the bottom line Toyota vehicle. It actually gets as good a gas mileage as the hybrid, but without the cost, and gets about 40 miles a gallon. It's a pretty darn good little car. Look, I appreciate that comment very much. And the reality is you got to be forward thinking. And in fact, that's why I try to take on everything. All in fact, the budget plan I wrote was basically it had a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year. Okay. But let's talk about some broader issues and some broader dynamics. Let's just take a healthy society. Well, to have a healthy society, you have to have a vibrant, educated workforce. You have to have a creative class, people that are highly trained and highly skilled workers. You know, I was the principal author in the House of House Joint Resolution 69 a few years ago that asked for us to create a blueprint for the future of higher education in Illinois. I grew up at EIU right on the grounds, literally a half a block off. My mom was at Eastern. She was director of administrative services. My wife's parents were faculty there. And the truth is somewhere between administration and faculty on that debate. But the reality is we haven't had a plan for where we want to be in higher education in Illinois since the 1980s. It was the last time we had a plan. And so we undertook, and it was a very lengthy very thorough study to create this new blueprint for where we want to be 20 years from now, not where we've been, where we want to be. And it, and frankly, I'm extremely proud of it on a lot of fronts, not just higher ed, but it went back and looked at what's coming out of our public school systems as well. And the problems in getting people to cross the bridge from high school to college and the amount of remedial work that has to be done in that. We now have the P20 Council, which is basically developing core curriculum standards so that people coming out of any school in Illinois are ready for the next step. Now, they're not ready to go to PhD, I'm not suggesting that, but ready to go to the next step, which would either be a junior college or a four-year college. That's in place. I'm extremely proud of that. I want to say something else, too. And, you know, and I get the drift of your call, but there's something out there called the FAIRMAP Amendment, and it's an extremely important concept because it gives the people of Illinois their democracy back. And when you talk about, look, we're here today in a new Senate district, 51st. It's a jigsaw puzzle piece that goes from Indiana to west of Decatur, from Bloomington to almost I-70, okay? It's crazy how it's drawn. The people are absolutely wonderful. Love the people. But to suggest that a Paris that affiliates with a Terre Haute, really, and a Hayworth that affiliates with Bloomington should be in the same Senate district is a little bit crazy. Now, why does that happen? Because in Illinois, we allow politicians to draw maps. And I'm not going to be a Republican on this and blame the Democrats. In the 90s, the Republicans drew the map. If you want to get your state back, you use FAIRMAP, which would use a computer. The computer wouldn't know political voting data, so it wouldn't know that Urbana is Democrat and Muhammad's Republican. It also wouldn't know incumbent addresses. And when you don't know political voting data and you don't know the addresses of who to protect or who to take out from an incumbent perspective, then a Mike Madigan can't be speaker for 30 years. And the FAIRMAP Amendment isn't Chapin Rose's idea by any means. I wish it was. It's the Farm Bureau. It's the League of Women Voters. It's Change Illinois. It's the State Chamber of Commerce. I mean, those are four very diverse, broad spectrum groups that really represent the breadth and diversity of the state of Illinois. And all four of them have come together and said, this is what we want to do. Now, here's the good thing. I happen to be the lead House sponsor of the FAIRMAP Amendment. Mike Magan's never going to let it be called for a vote. The good thing is the citizens can take it back themselves. This is one of the few places where in the Illinois state constitution that you are allowed to have a citizen ballot initiative, ballot referendum. Illinois is one of the most restrictive constitutions when it comes to citizens initiatives in the country. You know, out west, you have citizen initiatives for everything. But here, you really can't do much. You can do, what you can do is redistricting. So those folks, those groups we just talked about, we had a first run at it a few years ago. We got 120,000 signatures in about 4 weeks' time. I personally collected 100,000. Now, look, I'm not going to be Pollyanna here and pretend that did I just say 100,000? I meant 1,000. I'm sorry.
I thought
Dave give me a look here. Yeah,
that's a lot.
I personally collected 1,000 signatures. You know, but we're going to need, when this comes out again, you know, it's going to take 240,000. We got half of it in a month. When it comes out again, you know, I took my Republican hat off, and you put your citizen hat on. You want to leave it better than you came. And the reality is the FAIRMAP Amendment's our chance to do that, and I would urge everybody to get behind that.
We're down to the point here. We got a minute and a half. One thing I really got to ask you to talk about, if you can, is the pension issue.
Absolutely.
Particularly if you would make any kind of changes for people who are in the system now to reduce costs.
Sure. First of all, look, I've never voted to skip a pension payment, not one time. And, in fact, in 2005 when Governor Blagojevich proposed the two-year skip, I held a forum at Parkland College where I screamed bloody murder and said, if this passes in 2010, Illinois collapses. And that's exactly what happened. So I do believe that this is going to be a cooperative approach. That's how I do things. Everyone's going to have to be at the table. And quite frankly, people are now. They all realize whether you're a teacher who's looking at an $80 billion pension deficit and you're 30 years old and realize that's not going to be here when you retire, or the Tea Partier, we all need to shoot at the common target. And I think that's going to happen this year. The thing that I'm most, I think, encouraged by right now as you see the public universities, for example, coming forward with their own plans. Okay, heretofore, we've only had one plan, and that was 512, which I'm opposed to.
Is that the three-tier deal?
Yeah, it is, correct.
Okay.
And but that doesn't mean there's not a problem, and it means that we all have to be part of the pension solution. And I'm pleased to see that both sides are now coming together to try to negotiate through this. It's extremely important we get it done for everybody.
But do you think it's one thing to, you know, to talk about what the pension system's going to look like for people who are going to start to work for the University of Illinois, you know, a year from now? What about people who are in, and, you know, I have to say that, like me, I'm in and have been in for a long time.
First of all, there's a distinction here to be made, and that is, I think that there's more than one way to skin a cat. Mm. We're shooting at a 90% funded target by 2045, 35% is the liquidity point. If all you did was get with a normal, just a healthy assumption, maybe 70 or 80%, you could shave $1 billion off the annual pension payment right there and not reconfigure anything. But I was very happy to see the universities, for example, come out with their own plan. That's going to have to be part of this discussion.
Let me ask you about legislative scholarships. What do we do with those? Keep them? Get rid of them?
I gave mine to my school districts. Let them pick. Current retired educators picked. 3 years ago, I stopped giving them all together. I just had enough with the whole thing, and I've voted for, and I'm currently sponsoring legislation to eliminate the entire program.
Okay. Did you vote for the cell phone ban? A ban on cell phone use when driving?
Which one? There's texting I voted for.
Just recently the House passed a thing that said you can't talk on the cell phone while you're driving.
No, I did not vote for
you
that.
You did not? No. Why do you think it? Why?
My hypocrisy only goes so far.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus is Chapin Rose. Don't talk while you're driving. He represents the 110th District in Illinois House. He is a Republican, one of two that will compete in the primary next week to take their party spot on the ballot in the new 51st Illinois State Senate District. His opponent, Tom Plura, he was on this program February 27th. That's on our website. You can go back and watch and listen. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.